to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today writes features and feature films. She's a documentary maker and a company director. She also serves on boards of various philanthropic trusts and museums, including chairing Britain's National Gallery. She's published a biography, The Baroness, and her first novel, The Improbability of Love, has just been shortlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. And this week, she's been announced as the joint winner of the 2016 Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize. Hannah Rothschild, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have an instantly recognisable family name, and it's your family that inspired your novel, The Improbability of Love. So could you take us back to Frankfurt in the mid-19th century?
So the family started in Frankfurt. They lived in a place which was known as Jew's Lane, and they lived in a house which was 14 foot wide, which was palatial at the time, and for Jew's Lane, except that there were 12 children living in this 14 foot wide house. And during the Franco-Prussian War, the ghetto was shelled, and as a result, the family were able to move out of Jew's Lane. And the patriarch sent his five sons to the five capitals of Europe. And together they set up what was in effect the first international bank. And the sons used to write to each other, you know, in kind of Judendeutsche, it was called, which is a kind of Yiddish, and they would send letters via carrier pigeons. So they had this kind of incredible network of banking and information across these capitals, which nobody else had at the time.
And slowly set about amassing a fortune, which they spent on art.
Well, they spent part of it on art, not all of it on art. What happened was that they made a huge amount of money, really, between 1800 and 1815, in a very, very short period of time. And having made that money, they then realised, actually, that, you know, deals aren't just done in boardrooms. Deals are done in ballrooms, and they're done on hunting fields, and they're done in drawing rooms. So, you know, they needed really to integrate themselves into society. And what they did was to build these very large houses with ballrooms and drawing rooms. And basically, they used it as a way to entice people to come and see them, and therefore to kind of cross-pollinate different parts of business, which, as we know, is how business really works.
Mm. Now, obviously, you're descended from the British branch of the family. What sort of art were they buying?
They didn't buy for a long time because, of course, for a long time, they were worried, actually, both about what they should buy, and also they didn't particularly want to lift their heads above the parapet. As being Jews, they were very aware of a lot of anti-Semitism. So for a bit, they didn't buy art. But when they did start buying, they tended to buy what was fashionable at the time. And what was fashionable at the time when they were buying, i.e. in the kind of mid-19th century, was French furniture, French pictures. And Ferdinand, who was buying at Wadston, a house I'm still very involved with, was actually buying English portraiture. So he bought Reynolds and Gainsborough's. He particularly liked pictures of actresses and mistresses. We're not quite sure why, given that he was an almost entirely celibate human being after the death of his wife. But so that's what they... So they were competing at the time with, you know, first of all, the Marquesses of Hertford, who'd had the Wallace collection, and later on with the kind of robber barons of America.
Tell us about Wadston.
So Wadston is this absolutely fantastic Victorian version of a French High Renaissance chateau built on top of a hill in the middle of the Buckinghamshire countryside. So when you approach it, it's quite unlike anything else. It's kind of a bit of Disney thrown in with a bit of kind of classical architecture. And it's got turrets and it's got spinels and it's got grand staircases. And it, you know, it is very, very unexpected. And it was built by Ferdinand as really a kind of a way, I think, of coping with the death of his beloved wife and child. She died in childbirth, taking, unfortunately, the child with her. And he put everything into this house. And it became his mistress, it became his love affair, it became his raison d'etre. And he devoted his entire life to amassing this quite peculiar collection within the house, which is, as I said, quite rarefied pieces of French 18th century art and furniture, as well as rather strange kind of Wunderkammer, which is the kind of thing that the European princes would have bought. So I couldn't recommend a visit there more highly. It's a really unexpected place to go.
And you grew up surrounded by all this wonderful art. And of course, your relationship with the National Gallery goes back to when you were a small child too.
Indeed. So the National Gallery really was my playground. When it was raining, I grew up in London, and when it was raining, my father used to take his three daughters and his son to the National Gallery and literally let us run. And you know, the guards became our unofficial nannies. And in those days, of course, I didn't particularly like the pictures or the National Gallery. You know, it seemed to be rather a forbidding place, and the paintings didn't talk back or say anything very interesting. But I suppose that subliminally, they kind of got inside me in some way. So I kept going back to it throughout my life.
We've all had access to many of these wonderful works, mostly as a result of the generosity of families like yours. But what we don't all have is the inside track on the art world. And you know it from within. Tell us about that world.
Well, I started in the art world very young. I had a holiday job, you know, an internship at a dealer's called Colnaghi's, you know, when I was at school. And then I went to work at the Louvre again while I was at school, kind of trying to learn French, failing to learn French, trying. And then I made films and documentaries for the BBC about the art world. So it is a world that I've grown up in, and it's a world that I absolutely love. And my surprise is why more people don't set their novels in the art world, because as far as I can see, it's got absolutely everything you would want. It's got very colourful characters, it's got incredible beauty, it's got the very rich, it's got the very poor, it's got the very committed, it's got the very serious, it's got the skullduggerous, if there is such a word. And so it's a kind of real melting pot of stories and intrigue.
This inside knowledge set the scene, obviously, for your book, The Improbability of Love. But the heroine, Annie, isn't really of the art world at all, is she?
No, and I wanted to make the heroine, in a way, somebody who didn't know very much about the art world. So I thought it was important. I mean, I am an insider to a large extent, but actually many people look at art and look at the art world and quite understandably don't really understand it. You know, that why would a picture fetch over $100 million, for example, you know? Why is a picture, this picture, worth more than that picture? You know, who are these strange people who people the kind of art fairs around the world? You know, who are these types? And why would you put your money into art rather than into something else? So I wanted, in a way, to have an ingenue at the heart of the story who could lead us through some of these rather strange occurrences.
Absolutely, because those are questions that you look at in depth, because she buys a painting in ignorance and relatively cheaply, and it turns out to be worth a great deal. And you examine what gives art its value.
Indeed. I mean, the extraordinary thing about a picture is that effectively it's completely valueless. It's a piece of canvas with some marks on it, probably an oil paint. Now, that, let's face it, you know, you or I are not going to give, you know, even 50p for, you know, something which is a 300-year-old piece of cloth with some daubings all over it. So what then happens to make it valuable? And how do we attach value to things? And this is really at the heart of the book. So I'm trying to work out in the book, or try to explore anyway within the book, why something might be worth £100 million or why it might be worth £10. And of course, the only real difference between £100 million and £10 is desire. Because, of course, the price is set by how much somebody desires it, how much somebody wants to pay for it. And this seems to me to be the most kind of inexplicable, strange kind of indices, if you like, to give to anything. Mm. I mean, why on earth, why does desire set this incredible variation in price?
You talk about the rich needing to look to the soothing power of beauty, and that art makes mortals feel closer to heaven, beauty having an intrinsic value.
I think beauty does have an intrinsic value. I think that, you know, it's not a measurable one, but we all like looking beautiful. We all like looking better. We all like, I think, being associated with beauty. We like having beautiful things around us in our house. We like wearing beautiful clothes. And I think that the richer you get, in a way, the, you know, the kind of higher the stakes become. So if you are, you know, a very, very wealthy hedge funder, for example, whose bonus is, you know, God knows how many squillion a year, you know, why not spend it on a beautiful work of art? I do think that it has a kind of fairy dust that rubs off. And incidentally, that fairy dust is available to anyone. You can go into the National Gallery and you can get a bit of fairy dust from one of the pictures there. You don't have to own it, I don't believe, you know, in order to appreciate it.
Do you think it applies also to modern art?
Yes, I think that modern art actually fetches much higher prices than old masters at the moment. You know, modern art is the area actually where you see these stratospheric prices. So I think the world record at the moment is were two pictures recently, one by de Kooning, and I can't remember who the other one was by, that were changed hands recently for $500 million. Must be a new world record, I believe. Mm. Now, those are what are seen as modern art, you know, whereas, you know, there is an absolutely beautiful Pontormo, a portrait of a man, for example, which is an incredibly rare painting. which we may soon lose to America. It's been bought, we think, by an American. It's got an export stop on its license at the moment, but that's gone for $30 million. So, you know, how do you, you know, to me, it's unfathomable that something painted, you know, very recently is worth, you know, five times, six times as much as something which is exquisitely rare and, you know, perhaps, you know, there are only a few of these in the world.
Part of the book's narrated by the Watteau painting at the centre of the story, and it, the painting describes characters and personalities of other paintings. It's a wonderful device, and I found the Watteau slightly waspish.
Well, he's I like to think of him as a very, very grumpy old man, and as he points out, he's 300 years old, and he says, you know, well, I'm frankly a spring chicken in the kind of panoply of art history, you know, which, let's face it, goes back to cave paintings many thousands of years ago. But, you know, he's been manhandled, he's been stuck in a junk shop, he knows he's a masterpiece. He was born in France, but he's travelled all over the world. He's been owned by extremely important people during his lifetime. And now he ends up with a kind of impoverished cook in Shepherd's Bush. And he's furious, frankly, you know.
Writing as the painting, you say that at the heart of all human anxiety is loneliness. I thought that was such a wonderful, wonderful line.
Well, I personally feel that loneliness is. That's what I think. You know, I think that we are. I mean, I don't want to become a kind of cod philosopher on your radio program, but I mean, I do think it is the kind of fundamental anxiety that seems to drive most people mad and most people to achieve things and most people to form relationships and everything else. It seems to me to be, you know, the main undercurrent under human experience.
You were talking about as a small child running about the gallery and none of the painting particularly speaking to you, but I wonder if Watteau has a particular resonance.
Well, Watteau was one of the first artists who spoke to me. And again, now having been a cod psychologist, I'm now going to sound like an absolute, you know, weirdo. So, but actually, you know, paintings do, for me, have messages. And so in the particular case of Watteau, I was 16. I was working at the Louvre. I was very, very lonely. I was unhappy. I couldn't speak French. You know, I didn't know who I was, what I was doing in this strange museum, you know, a long way from home. And I walked around a corner one day and I came face to face with a Watteau picture of Gilles, which is a clown who looks sadder and more lonely and more kind of uncomfortable than anything I'd ever seen, even than myself at that time. And it gave me tremendous comfort. I really felt that the painting and the painter understood what I was feeling.
There's a dark secret behind the painting in the book, and this, again, goes back to your own family history.
Yes. So my family were prominent Jews in Europe at the time of the outbreak of the Second World War, and were lucky enough to have the most fantastic collection of paintings. And they had many thousands of really seriously wonderful paintings and works of art and books, etc., etc. And as we know, when Hitler came to power, one of his ambitions was to create the world's greatest museum in Linz. And he and Goering and various other people who worked for him made a list of the preeminent paintings and objects in the world that he wanted to own. And quite a lot of those belonged to the Rothschild family. So he had a specific kind of art group, if you liked, who worked under him. And they went around trying to collect these works of art. So, for example, you have the Ghent altarpiece, or you had a Vermeer of the astronomer, which belonged to my family, is just two examples of the pictures he had his eye on. And he hoovered up a lot of Rothschild pictures. Indeed, he stole 3,200. We know how many he stole because he kept very, very meticulous records. It's one of the reasons we were able to get quite a lot of it back after the war. So I grew up knowing about this history and knowing about the pictures that he'd stolen, and knowing, of course, that there were still some out there. So it's now this story, of course, we read about it often in the newspaper. We have the story of Gurlitt recently. Do you remember the man in Munich who stashed away many, many paintings in his apartment and was recently discovered? But, you know, hardly a week goes by where we don't see someone trying to get a family painting that was stolen by the Nazis restituted.
Mm. You wrote a wonderful long piece about it in Vanity Fair, and you talked to Anne Weber, I think,
Indeed, in
that piece, who's in fact been a guest here at Monocle. And she was very concerned about the actions of so-called air hunters.
Yes, well, indeed, there are a lot of very scrupulous lawyers. I'm sure we all know many. But there are some unscrupulous lawyers who basically they go through the history of missing pictures and they try and match paintings that are missing to potential heirs of the original owners. You know, it might be their great niece or their great granddaughter or son, or in some cases, actually, even some of them are alive. And what those people do is therefore say, if we get this picture back, we should take a percentage of the value of the work of art. So they go on a kind of pro bono. And what Anne Weber and people like herself do, which is an extraordinary service, frankly, those people, is to try and get works of art back for people without taking fees. So there are goodies out there and there are baddies.
Now, of course, a lot of that fed into the film The Monuments Men, George Clooney's vehicle. Do you think that that made a difference, that movie, to how people perceive it and to perhaps what's been done about it now?
Well, I'm ashamed to say I actually didn't see the film, so I don't feel terribly qualified to talk about it. But I think that certainly films like that, as well as newspaper articles, as well as the fact that institutions like the Getty now have published some of the Nazi records, mean that we're not only more aware, but actually people can try and find works of art that are missing. And I think the second thing is a much more kind of emotional fact, really, is that immediately after the war, those survivors and those relatives of survivors put all their efforts just simply into trying to recreate a life. And they weren't really thinking at that moment, I think, about what they'd lost in terms of their possessions. They were more thinking about who they'd lost in terms of their relatives and how they might kind of re-establish their lives. But, you know, as generations pass, I think the later generations can think, OK, what did that person own and what might I get back? And sometimes it's for monetary reasons and sometimes it's for sentimental reasons.
We were talking about the film, and of course you're a filmmaker yourself, and in fact you were making stories visually before you started writing.
Yes. So I started off, I went straight from university to the BBC, and I worked there until actually quite recently. And I don't see a big division between telling stories on film and telling stories in a biographical form or in a newspaper form or indeed in a novel. I think that it's all part of the same thing. The disciplines are slightly different, clearly. And also how pegged you are to fact. If you're writing fiction, you can be slightly more fluid. But I don't really see a huge difference between them all.
So documentaries on Peter Mandelson, on Joan Collins.
Yes, Joan. That was my first documentary, actually. And that was a very, very good baptism by fire. I have enormous respect for Joan Collins, but she was not the easiest person, perhaps, to make my your first film about.
One of the films gave rise to your wonderful book about your ancestor, the jazzy baroness, Nika. Could you give us a snapshot of her story and also how you made that shift? As you say, quite an easy one, but from films to books.
Yeah. So Nika was someone who I didn't even hear about when I was a child. And I found her one day in a family tree. I suddenly saw a great aunt called Panonika. And I thought, my goodness, that's a marvellous name. And secondly, I thought, how do you lose a great aunt? How can you can just literally, she's never talked about. And then I started, you know, hearing more and more rumours about her. So that she lived with a black man, that, you know, she had run away to New York, that she flew Lancaster bombers during the war, that, you know, it got more and more and more exciting, frankly, you know, to a young girl, which I was at the time. And so the first opportunity I had, I went to New York and I cold called her. And I remember I said, you know, hi, this is your great niece, I said rather nervously. And there was an incredibly long pause. And then she went, wild, which I thought was just, you know, what more can you want from a great aunt? Anyway, I went to meet her and we became friends. And although then in those days, of course, it was much harder to go backwards and forwards across the Atlantic. So our friendship tended to be in terms of her sending me records to try and educate me about jazz. I knew there was a film there. I absolutely knew there was a film, and I knew there was a film that I needed to make about her, about how you try and escape from your family, about the jazz world in the 1950s, about, you know, being a white woman hanging out with black men and what that meant. But I couldn't get anyone to commission it. And even though I had a reasonably good reputation, I think, as a filmmaker at that point, you know, they steered really clear of this film. So I took a small handheld camera with me whenever I went filming. And if I happened to see that Sonny Rollins, for example, was playing nearby or another kind of jazz great was there, I would ring them up and say, can I come and talk to you? So over the years, I amassed a lot of material. I then eventually did make the film for Storyville for the wonderful Nick Fraser, who commissioned it. And it went down very well. But, you know, in a film, there's only so much you can tell because a film is very much bound by what you show. And you can't really necessarily get into detail. It's more about creating atmosphere. It's about the collision of pictures with voices, with story. And I'd had all this research based on many, many years of going around and talking to these extraordinary people. And I thought, I can't leave it at a film. I just can't. So then I decided to write the biography.
which is a fantastic book.
And
thank
I
mean,
you.
Such a wonderful history of jazz, too.
Thank you. Well, I mean, as I say, I'm not somebody who knows a lot about jazz even now, but I think sometimes it's quite useful being someone who doesn't know everything when you're writing about something, because you can have a kind of slightly different perspective. You don't get quite so bogged down in the kind of, whether that was an E flat or G sharp, whatever it might be. And I'm betraying my ignorance immediately.
Of course, that was an impeccably researched biography. And this book, your new book, The Improbability of Love, is a fictional story, but as we discussed, based on live events. And I wonder if it was a very different experience writing it.
Yeah, it was completely different. I mean, I had hope, funnily enough, having done these documentaries and having written the biography, that I could be freed completely from fact-checking and you know, from being accurate. Of course, actually, that isn't the case. You still have to be accurate and you still have to fact-check, because it's so irritating people when they discover a big mistake, which indeed, you know, I have made big mistakes, you know, in many things I've done. So I wasn't completely freed from facts. But what is exciting about it is that with a biography, you, in a way, you're bound by the person's life or by the events. But in a narrative book, a fictional book, you can kind of go off-piste. And indeed, you know, I went shooting. You know, I didn't expect at the beginning that some of the characters that appear in the book were going to appear. It just seemed like a good moment when I went, oh, that would be fun. I wonder what that person might be like. And the book at first was a very, very unwieldy kind of 1,000 pages. I'm happy to say it's been kind of heavily cut down, but I think the next time I write, I'll have more of a kind of roadmap about where to go.
At least one of the characters was based on a real person.
Yes, I don't think he minds me saying this. So I made a film about Nicky Haslam, who is a kind of, he's more than a decorator. He's someone who, firstly, he's a fantastically funny, amusing, interesting person. And I wanted to make a film about him because, in a way, I wanted to understand society through his eyes, because he's very much part of society. You know, he was the son of an earl. His mother was Queen Victoria's goddaughter. You know, he's very much part of that whole world. And I quite wanted to understand what that world was through his eyes. Anyway, and he's a real bon vivant. What he does is that, in theory, he goes in and tells people how to decorate their houses. But actually, in practice, he does a lot more than that. He almost gives them a life. He kind of says, this is what you should wear, and this is where you should eat, and this should be your hobbies. Because many people are coming from foreign countries. They don't know how England works. Of course, he does. So I just thought, well, actually, he's so much part of the fabric of English life. Why not put a character inspired by him in the book?
Now, the fictional protagonist is a chef, and she makes a magnificent feast based on a painting. There are some wonderful foodie gems in the book that just cry out for more investigation, like the On Honourable Pleasure and Health, recipes collated in 1465.
Yeah. Well, listen, if you're a procrastinator, which I am, I'm afraid, and if, you know, many writers are, because, you know, the actual business of writing is quite a slog. So there's nothing more delicious, frankly, than going researching recipes. So I spent many, many, many hours kind of drooling over cookery books in the London Library and elsewhere. And a lot of the, I mean, actually, it is all absolutely true. Not only that, I then talk about really big procrastination. I then decided to cook some of these recipes myself to see whether they worked. Now, I'm not a good cook. I'm a grade A eater, but I'm not a very good cook. So it took many, 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 many times too long to make them. And the results were pretty foul, frankly. But I thought I might as well give it a go.
You've been shortlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for fiction for this book. The award, as the name implies, is for women. It was set up after the Booker Prize of 1991, when none of the six shortlisted books was by a woman, despite some 60% of novels published that year being by female authors. Now, obviously, it's great making the shortlist, but do you think that women need special treatment? Wouldn't we protest at a prize exclusively for men?
Yes, I think there is certainly. Listen, I'm not going to, having been nominated for this prize, I'm not going to rubbish it. I'm absolutely thrilled to have got this far, I can tell you. So I'm certainly not going to diss it. It's a really interesting thing about quotas, isn't it? I mean, it's a wider issue than prizes. It's about quotas. Should we actually have quotas for women? So that, for example, we know that a tiny, tiny percentage of boards in this country, non-executives, are women. We know that women, you know, let's look at the amount of women in Parliament. Let's look at the amount of women all over the place. I mean, it is shocking how, when we're 51% of the population, how underrepresented we are in all areas of public life. And having been rather against quotas for the reasons you said, you know, do you want to prescribe it? Actually, I'm now beginning to think that, you know, things aren't changing quickly enough. And why not actually say, right, if they're not changing, we need to change them? And back to the Baileys, I mean, would I mind about a man's prize? Well, not I mean, no, you can't say it's okay to have a women's prize and not say it's not okay to have a men's prize. Do I wish that there was more parity? Yeah, sure I do.
You've been enormously successful in what was formerly seen as a man's preserve, that of business. So you've worked within your father's finance business.
Yeah, I'm actually the first female Rothschild that I know about who works in a family business. The original founding father, N.M. Rothschild, prescribed that no woman should ever be employed except as a bookkeeper or an archivist. And it's absolutely incredible. And that rule held firm. And my father, Jacob, is, I think, rather an enlightened person who happens to get on very well with women and actually tried to persuade me for many, many years to work with him in the family businesses. And actually, it's taken me some time to get there. I'm pleased I'm doing it. I'm also pleased I had another career first.
And, of course, you're a trustee of the Tate, and now you're also the chair of the National Gallery here in Britain.
Well, it's so extraordinary to think that this place, which I've loved and visited since I was a child, I'm now leading the trustees. So there's lots to do there. And it's, I must say, becoming a chair was quite a different role to being a trustee, which I was for, I think, 7 years beforehand. I'm not sure I quite appreciated what the step up would mean, not just in terms of responsibility, but just in terms of time and actually, you know, what a chair does. Mm. So I feel that I'm at the beginning of what's going to be a very exciting journey. Luckily, we've got a new director and he and I get on very well, Gabriele Fainaldi. And there are many plans, you know, which we are thinking about when to launch. We know what they are, but we don't know when to launch them quite yet. So I think it's an exciting time.
How do you fit in all of your day jobs with your writing? And of course, the whole publicity train of having a new book out.
Yeah, it is quite difficult, I must say. I do find it difficult. I find multitasking difficult. I find trying to remember what exactly I'm doing on each day or sometimes each hour of each day quite difficult. But I also feel that, in a way, you know, this won't last that long, this kind of moment. So just go for it. And if I get overtired, I get overtired. You know, so what? You know, this is a really exciting, quite unique moment, you know, when you have a book out that's doing very well and the other things, touch wood, are doing very well. So actually, I just feel kind of really excited, actually. I think that's maybe my adrenaline, perhaps.
You describe so beautifully the feeling of when one's transported by a great work of art and surrounded, as you still are, by magnificent pieces every day. Do you still feel a tremble in your soul?
When I see a great work of art? I absolutely do, actually, you know. I think it's... I'm trying to think the last time that I... The last time where I did, I went to Venice for my mum's 80th birthday party and we went to the Academy, anyway, in Venice, and there was a Lorenzo Lotto picture of a man reading a book. And Lorenzo Lotto is not a painter I knew very much about at the time, but there was something about that picture. And I just turned a corner and we were going to see Tintoretto, and we weren't going to see Lorenzo Lotto. And there it was. And I just felt this kind of shiver of kind of, whoa, this is something extraordinary. And there was some way about the man holding the book and the way he was looking at the audience and the colours it was painted in that was kind of, I've got this kind of tingle. In fact, I'm getting it now as I'm talking to you about it. And then what was so exciting is I then went on a kind of Lorenzo Lotto journey and looking at all his other paintings and learning about him. Of course, there's not much known about him. And it's taken me on this, you know, so everywhere I go now, I think, is there a Lorenzo Lotto in their museum, you know, and I go off and find it. So it is, I mean, it's like kind of fireworks. It's something goes off, a big bang, and then suddenly lots of other things follow it. So I find it really thrilling, in fact.
And you, too, have come up with an absolute thrilling work. The Improbability of Love by Hannah Rothschild is published by Bloomsbury. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to producer Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.